This is an international podcast transmission. Is anyone out there? If you're listening, you've reached the No Fixed Agenda podcast.
I know exactly what it is. It's my Lego.
It's your Lego.
My nephew did it for me, so
yeah.
I keep it as a little.
As a
problem is, my nephew's 22, so it's not like he's a tyke. He's a grown man, but he still did it for me.
Still playing with Legos.
That's the generation, man.
Dude, it's not even a generational. It's a Lego thing, dude.
It's a Lego thing.
It is
if you're,
total.
If you're
Lego
into
thing.
Lego thing, it's
a Lego, dude. I know. 60-year-olds that have like built cities of Legos in their, like they apply to, they shared their spare rooms like a Lego museum, dude.
I know.
It's kind of nuts.
I never got into Legos. Did you?
Me neither.
Dude, did you ever get into Legos?
As a kid, I did, yeah.
I couldn't afford it, bro.
Well, well, they're definitely more expensive now.
Yeah, dude. See,
so I was never really into them that much, but you always have them when you're a kid. And it was always like that. I don't think they really did very many of the build outs like this, right? Like it's, hey, here's a model that you can go after. It's pretty much just give you a block of Legos and you're like,
and then
you figure it out.
Yeah. Now they're like puzzle pieces.
Now they're all puzzle pieces.
Yeah, it's like you get
I'm
one
surprised
in.
I'm like, surprised that people are still doing tactile thing. Like not every, you think everything is online these days. So it's nice to know that people are actually doing physical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I actually told him like he's going to be graduating college here next May.
Yeah.
And I keep on asking him, like, what are you going to do? Do you have any plans? And I was like, honestly, man, he's into a lot of the radio DJ stuff. Mm-hmm. He's a DJ for his radio station in college, like the late night shift, like 3 a.m. shift. But he also is into the Lego thing. I'm like, you know, we do have Legoland out here. I'm sure we could figure out a way to get you an internship somehow, like maybe Legoland.
Then he could play building, with really big Legos.
They could just play with big Legos the entire time.
Dude, they build cities, man. Have you seen that yet? Have you been to Legoland?
I've been to Legoland, but it's been a while. But
dude,
yeah,
it's like the city. I took my grandson there, dude. It was just... like, holy crap.
You have a grandson already?
Yeah, I have a grandson already.
He's got six kids, man.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get off the Lego.
Let's get off the Lego. Let's talk about who we got in the room first, bro.
Dr. Jason Karp, thank you for joining us today. We're talking about a little bit of... you and I got connected because of the Donut Dash that we've got coming up. We're both on the USA San Diego Track and Field board. So we're kind of connected in that regard, but this is the first time that we're actually sitting down and chatting.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you reached out to me about was your current book, Can You Outrun a Donut?
Correct.
we've got a Donut Dash 5K and Donut Mile coming up in September. So there was this nice little connection with everything. And I was on your website and I started looking through everything. Congratulations, Bobby. 17-time author.
Yeah.
And
400 publications.
Dude.
Yeah.
I
spent a lot of time writing.
Yeah, I guess.
No kidding.
So
that's why I don't have six kids.
Yeah. Your kids are like your publications, man.
Each book is like a little child.
Well, yes, 100%.
Yeah.
So I want to get into the current book so we can talk about Can You Outrun the Donut? But I want to get a little bit of background. And I actually watched your TEDx on your online, and it kind of gives you a little bit of that background of what got you into where you're at, the running and the coaching stuff. So kind of give our listener a little bit of that background. Like, how did you get into the coaching aspect and into running?
Yeah, it started when I was a kid. So my first love was actually baseball. And I played a lot of baseball and then got into soccer. And then in sixth grade, I started running track. And I just immediately became interested in the science of athletic performance. It actually started with baseball. Like my first scientific question I had was, how does a baseball pitcher throw a curveball? I was fascinated by the physics of that, how the pitcher can get the ball to move in the air like that to confuse the batter. I still find that the curveball a fascinating study of physics and the merging of physics and sport. I think it's very interesting.
Wow.
So I started having these questions as a kid, and it just grew from there. Like, I was placed on this path that I never wavered from. I knew I wanted to study the science of athletic performance. And so that just directed everywhere I went to school. I wanted to study under the best so that I could be the best. So I was very particular about where I went to school. And I just, I never knew anything else. I just fell in love with this subject as a kid.
Yeah.
And everything just grew from there. And I knew that coaching was going to be the center of everything. Like, I didn't know when I was a kid, like, what job I would have. But I knew that since I realized at a pretty young age, well, I was quite fast when I was in middle school. I ran a 59-second 400 meters in middle school. But then when I got to high school and all the other kids started to catch up to me, I realized that it was just because I reached puberty earlier than everyone else. And so I was strong, I was fit, I was fast in middle school. I started shaving when I was in eighth grade.
What?
I mean, I had this surge of testosterone at a pretty young age compared to all the other kids.
You were like Superman at that
right,
age.
Exactly. That's how I felt. Like, I was able to arm wrestle everybody. I was like the arm wrestle, yeah. You know, like the amateur arm wrestle champion. I was challenging everyone in classes to arm wrestle. And I set the middle school district chin-up record in eighth grade. I did 24 chin-ups when I was in eighth grade. And so I was fit. I was fast. And I'm the same size now as I was then. I grew really
just
fast.
Just stopped growing.
And so I thought, well, maybe I really have some talent at this running thing.
Oh.
And then as I moved through high school and all the other kids started, they reached puberty and started catching up. And I realized that I didn't have that kind of talent to reach the Olympic dreams that I had as a kid.
Yeah.
But I always thought that if I don't have that kind of Olympic level talent myself, the next best thing is to coach others who do.
Yeah.
So I knew that coaching was going to be at the center of everything. But I didn't know what else I was going to do. And then just over the years, I pieced things together, the speaking, the writing, the certification program that I created, all of that stuff just kind of grew out of this initial love that I had for athletic performance.
I think it's interesting that you, in the sixth grade, you kind of had this mentality of, I want to study the science of it.
In fact, I was like geeking out on, like, there were two pivotal books, I think, in my life that I read that came out in the 80s when I was in middle school. One was written by, I forget the exact titles right now. One was like Sports Science Breakthroughs in Athletic Performance or something like that. And one was written by a journalist and one was written by a physicist in New York who studied sports science. And so I got my hands on those two books, and that was it for me. It was just having read that, and I knew that this was what I wanted to do, that I wanted to study the science of athletic performance and understand, like, elite athletic performance and what the body can do at its most extreme level. That's always been fascinating to me.
Here I talk about my nephew not knowing exactly what he's going to do at 22 years old.
Oh, yeah.
In sixth grade, this guy already kind of had an idea.
I think I was just one of those lucky ones that I found a subject as a kid.
Very rare, for sure.
And I literally ran with it.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people, that even when they're in college, they still don't know what they're going to do. And that's fine.
Yeah.
I just happened to have found this activity and this subject that I fell in love with.
I found it quite interesting. I saw that you became the youngest collegiate cross country coach.
Yeah,
is that right?
24. I was a head coach because that was my first real job. So after I finished my master's,
How did you end up with that position? Like,
I just applied. So when I was getting ready to finish I did my master's degree at the University of Calgary. So I was living up in Canada, and I knew I wanted to get the PhD, but I wanted to take some time off. I didn't want to just go all those years of school straight. I wanted to get some experience. So I was just applying for jobs around the U.S. And I landed this job in New Jersey. I was at a small school, all women's college. Oh, wow. And I was the head cross country coach. It was great. I loved it.
Yeah. What was your first? That was your first coaching gig?
Yeah, that was my first. I was 24. Yeah.
Imagine that, dude.
Yeah.
No.
You're sitting there going, like, dude, are you serious?
Yeah.
Like,
I wasn't that much older than the athlete. The seniors on the team were 22, 21, 22.
Yeah. You're like,
so I was pretty close in age to them.
If you weren't in an all-girl school, they would have thought you were.
Right. Because I looked like a student. I didn't have this gray hair back then. So, I could have easily passed for a student. Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
How long were you a cross-country coach?
At that school, I was only there 1 year because then I ended up moving to San Francisco.
Okay.
So, I didn't stay there that long.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then that lead into more coaching
Yes, I coached at a couple of high schools in San Francisco.
Okay.
Also did some personal training. I taught at UC Berkeley, had an extension program. They offered a fitness certificate. So I taught some classes in their program. That was great to teach on the Berkeley campus. I was in my mid-20s. I was teaching on the Berkeley campus. That was pretty cool.
That's not bad. Yeah. That's not a bad
gig. Talk about an overachiever, bro.
And then I ended up being in San Francisco only like a little less than 2 years because then I went back to school to pursue the PhD.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what was the PhD in?
Exercise physiology. Nice. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then when did the... So I think your first book was a non-running book,
right?
It was
about the PhD.
It was about the PhD.
It's called How to Survive Your PhD.
And then everything else after that has just been
running and fitness.
Running and fitness specific. Yeah. Oh, man, that's...
How to run a marathon for dummies.
Yeah. So that one I got lucky with because I got... So when I started writing the PhD book, I knew that book writing was something I wanted to do. Like I had an English minor in college. I knew I was talented at writing. Mm. So I knew I wanted to write books for the rest of my career. So I found a literary agent in New York. And so she got me that gig because you can't decide to write one of the dummies books yourself. That's a branded book. That's one publisher that publishes.
That's why I'm asking about it.
That's why I'm kind of interested in that too. Yeah.
So they came to my agent and asked her if she knew anyone who wanted to write a running a marathon for dummies. And she said, in fact, actually, I do have one. So she asked me if I were interested. Of course, I said yes, because, you know, you don't turn down that kind of an opportunity. So that one fell in my lap. All the other books that just started with my idea, and then I write the book proposal and send it to my agent. But with that one, that came from her through the publisher. That came to her, then came to me. And so, I got lucky with that one.
How long were you a personal trainer, and where was that, in San Francisco as well?
That also started in New Jersey. So when I had that job at the college in New Jersey, it was only part-time. Even though I was the head coach, it was a part-time job.
Oh.
So I had to find other things to do. So I worked at a couple of gyms there, and then I continued to do that in San Francisco, and I moved there. So I did that for quite a while. And then even when I came out here, then I was past the PhD. I was in my mid-30s when I moved out to San Diego, and I was still doing that, not in a gym, but I was doing it. The great thing about San Diego, you can be a personal trainer all year round outside on your own. You don't need to be associated with a gym.
Yeah.
So I was finding clients here and there, and I was doing that for quite a while. You know, and that led me to win the IDEA Personal Trainer of the Year Award, which is IDEA Health and Fitness Association. And,
how do you win the Personal Training of the Year Award?
I want to know because I need to apply.
Inquiring minds want to know. If you're in your 40s and 50s, you'll understand that reference. Inquiring minds want to know.
100%. If you're in your 20s, you have no idea. No.
Anyway.
So how did that come about? Talk to me about that journey.
Well, I would love to be able to say that I was just nominated out of the blue by somebody.
Somebody saw you doing this amazing work.
Right.
You had all these before and after results.
Yeah. All these things you have to apply for.
Okay.
So you can get nominated. If you have a friend who wants to nominate, you can get nominated for that award, but you still have to fill out the entire application.
Mm.
So it's a pretty long application. There are essays. You got to basically put together a portfolio of your work. And it helps if you're known. Like I was presenting at a lot of fitness industry conferences. I'd presented at IDEA conference. I presented at other conferences. So between my writing and speaking, I started to gain a reputation in the field. People started to know who I am. So then when the judges saw my application, well, they already know, even though they say it's a blind review, but it has identifiers in the application. They know who I am. So, I'm sure that all of that helped because I already had a platform at the time that I applied for the award.
Yeah. Sorry, man, you're a nobody.
I am a nobody.
You are a nobody.
I mean, a somebody to somebody, but not a nobody in this big.
Yeah.
I mean, how long ago was that, though?
I won that award in 2011.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's been a while.
Yeah, so I got to write a couple books, which is...
But I was lucky with that, too. I was only 3 years out of school at the time. I'd finished the PhD at the end of 2007, moved out here at the beginning of 2008, and I won that award in 2011. So I was only out of school a few years, but I had already been writing a lot while I was in school, speaking a lot while I was in school.
I've always, to talk about the speaking aspect of it, I've always kind of been interested in a little bit of that and how people get into that. You know, we've had another individual on here who did a TEDx talk as well. And he got into it, like he always wanted to do one. And so through the process, he ended up getting the TEDx talk and stuff. But I'm always kind of curious how people get into the speaking. How do people end up like understanding that you're actually a good public speaker, right? That's a huge thing. Like,
yeah,
well, like where was your, what was your first one?
It starts small, but then it, just like anything else, it grows from there. And a lot of these things you have to apply. You know, yeah. A lot of them is just application. It's very rare that someone comes to you. I mean, maybe if you're a big time celebrity and they want you to do a, you know, give a keynote and they come to you because you're a public figure.
Yeah.
But for everybody else, like the fitness industry conferences, they have formal application because you have to pitch them ideas with a description of what you're going to talk about. Mm. If you have video clips of you speaking, then it helps if you can share that with people. And then, or they also ask you sometimes, where have you spoken the last year? So it helps if you have. Yeah. So it starts small like anything else. You can start, you don't have to start with the national conferences. But then also like the track and field and cross country coaching clinic, I do a lot of those. And that's much more informal. That's just, sometimes they do reach out to me because at this point they know who I am. Or sometimes I just email them and ask them, are you looking for any speakers? This is what I can speak on. Again, I give them a list of possible topics. You know, so that's not a formal application. Usually the big fitness industry conferences like CanFit Pro in Canada or IDEA here and some of the other ones, they have like a formal online application where you have to submit your bio, you have to submit your credentials, you have to submit the topics you're going to talk about and the descriptions of those topics, learning objectives, all of that stuff.
What was your first speaking engagement?
I'd have to go back. I mean, that was like probably 1999 or 2000, but if I remember correctly, it was a U.S. Track Coaches Association. It happened to have been held locally. That I was living in Albuquerque, and their national conference was in Albuquerque that year.
Wow.
And so I reached out to them and got a chance to speak there. Yeah.
How nervous were you? First one's always the rip the bandaid, right? I'm only saying that because, you know, when I first, the first episode here was very nerve-wracking for
me.
Yeah, I always tell people that will ask me like, yo, you have a podcast? Yeah, but don't listen to the first 10 episodes, please.
Well, I think too, like Omar and I have both talked openly about how I think both of us wouldn't mind doing the public speaking thing, right? So
that's kind of what we're interested in doing.
I recommend it to everyone. I mean, as long as you feel comfortable, I mean, because you are going to be nervous. I mean, the first time I spoke, I was quite nervous.
Yeah.
But at this point now, I mean, it's like a drug for me. I mean, I absolutely love it.
Wow.
And when I get done and then I go back into my hotel room all by myself, it's like a downer.
Yeah.
You know, like I can't wait for that next hit. It's really weird. It is kind of like a drug.
And He's addicted to writing and speaking. Yeah. Right? That's a good addiction.
I just absolutely love standing in front of people, sharing the passion, sharing my expertise. You know, but when I first started doing it, even though I still had that love and it was still felt like a drug, of course I was nervous. But I get around that by being the expert in the room. Mm. I would be a lot more nervous if I were speaking about something that I'm not an expert on.
Got it.
You know, then you're fumbling for your thoughts and you're wondering what to say and you don't want people to see through you. But at this point, and it's not even at this point, it only didn't take that long because even when I got that first speaking opportunity, I was already working on a PhD at the time. Mm. And so it didn't take that long for me to feel really comfortable in front of other people and my education and expertise being like that shield. Like I knew that I was the expert in the room.
Got it.
And every time I enter the room, I try to command the room. Not talking down to people because I don't want them to think that I'm, I don't want to come across that way. But I know that I know more than everyone else in the room. And that's not a cocky or arrogant thing to say. That's just the confidence that comes along with being a public speaker. If you want to influence people and you want them to listen to what you have to say, of course you have to be the expert. Otherwise, why else would they listen to what you have to say?
Oh.
They'll just go Google it if they want to know the answer.
Yeah.
What was that first talk on?
I think it was on periodization, if I remember correctly.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think
it
was
on. What's your favorite topic to talk about?
That's tough to say because I've been lucky enough to have, like a lot of my talks now are based on the books. Like I turned the book into a talk. It's so like even that periodization talk that has changed over the years because one of my books is on running periodization.
Hmm.
So I've changed that talk and, I lived in Kenya. I've turned that into a talk because I have that book about that, Coaching the Kenyans.
Yeah.
So I turned that into it. I've given that talk several times at coaching clinics around the country. And that's a fun one because it's also based on a personal experience. So I can share the experience of living in Kenya and coaching these athletes there And what I learned from them, because that's one of the reasons I went there, is not just so I can teach them, because there's no scientific training over there. So it wasn't just about me teaching them. I want to learn about how they do things and how I can blend what they do with the science of what I do. And so I love sharing that talk with people. The coaches eat that up. They absolutely love it, because you know, everyone's enamored with the Kenyan runners. And so to learn their, quote, secrets of how they do things and what makes them unique, when I speak to coaches about that, they absolutely love that talk.
That's what I was going to ask you about. How did that come about when you're the first American Kenyan coach there?
It was a choice I made. I knew that other people... I have the kind of life that allows me to do what I want.
Right.
So if I want to go move to Kenya, I can go move to Kenya. Whereas if you have six kids, you can't go move to Kenya.
They're all grown now. I can do whatever the hell I want.
Well, that's good. But when they were growing up.
Yeah, when they were growing up, there was hell no. A lot of opportunities lost.
So I went there for myself. They have camps there because a lot of people, you know, they're so enamored with the Kenyan culture and Kenyan running that there are organizations that hold camps in this small rural town, which is the epicenter.
So you didn't have, nobody invited, you just had the idea to go up there. You're like, I really want to know what they're doing here.
Yeah. So I went to the camp there first, just for myself. It was a 2-week camp. So I went there as a runner myself. And then while I was there and I saw what went on, that's what gave me the idea. And I thought, wow, this would be a great place to move to, live here and coach here. And so then I had to put the plan together of how I was going to do that, where I was going to live and everything. And then the pandemic hit.
Wow. So and this it is during affected the pandemic.
It, So, because I went there in 2019.
Whoa.
And then when I finally got the idea to actually move there, well, that was a year later than the pandemic. So I had to wait till that subsided until, because it affected them there. They all train in groups and that was all shut down. The schools were shut down. Everything was shut down.
Wow.
And they don't have, you know, the students over there, they don't have Zoom like we have here. So all those kids lost a whole year of school. Wow. I'm sure the kids were happy. But that hurts, obviously, the country when you have a whole generation that misses a year of school.
Yeah.
So so that's really bad. But that's the situation in Africa. You know, they don't have access to the internet like we have here in every single home in America. We have access to the internet. They don't have that there. So I had to wait till the pandemic subsided. And then finally, in November of 2021, kind of at the tail end of things, you know, that's when I moved there. And when I got there, people were still wearing masks. And Eldoret, which is the closest major city, which was like 45 minutes away from where I was living, they have a shopping center there and a mall there, and it's a city, even though it's still a by Kenyan standards, it's not like you think of a mall in the U.S. It's not like this, but still, they have more than what they had in the rural towns. So, like when you enter into the shopping center in Eldoret, they had a hand washing station, they had a guard there to make sure everybody washed their hands, and you wear a mask and. So it was when I experienced that over there that that's when I realized that this pandemic really is all over the world. It's not just, you know, we tend to think in the U.S. that life is about the U.S., but
we're a little pighead.
But when going over there on the other side of the entire world and seeing what went on. And so, but that was already starting to subside when I got there. And then by the time I left there, everything was gone. No more hand washing stations outside the mall, no more mask wearing, and everything was back to complete normal. I ended up being there 6 months.
Okay.
I had no idea how long I was going to go. I thought maybe I'll go up to a year and we'll see how things go. Because the difficulty of coaching there is that that they don't have any money. And so they look to outsiders. So I was trying to, I gave them some of my own money. I was trying to raise money. I did a GoFundMe while I was there to try to raise money for them. A few times I took them to that shopping center in Eldoret and had them go food shopping. The first time they had ever been in a supermarket. Wow. It was like literally watching a kid in a candy store. They had no idea what to do or how to spend money. It was my money that they were spending, but they had no idea how to budget. I mean, they just, they have no concept of this because they just
live off the land.
And I mean, they don't have refrigerators and freezers to store food. So they eat very little, but what they eat is healthy because they're eating off the land. It's all, you know, a lot of vegetables, potatoes, you know, rice, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's just a very interesting experience, especially about the enormous amount of physical work that they can do on such little food. It's unbelievable. They have metabolisms that have been trained over many, many years to make the most out of the least.
Wow.
And it's just fascinating.
Talk to us about a little bit about that culture shock. You mentioned something earlier when you talked about going over to Kenya and you were like, there's not a whole lot of science behind what they do.
Yeah, they have no idea.
And so
idea.
You already had your PhD at this point, right? Yeah. So you're going in with all of this knowledge.
Yeah.
And you're like, they're turning around just telling you what they're doing.
Yeah.
How enlightening was it to be able to say, to apply your knowledge to what they were doing?
Oh, it was very. I mean, I didn't give them the detail. Like, I told them some stuff, but yeah, I wasn't going to talk to them about details about VO2 max or lactate pressure because they don't, you know.
They don't care about periodization and none of that stuff.
They don't understand.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not educated. Most of them don't go to college unless, you know, unless some of the Kenyans come over here or they get a scholarship to go to college. That's what they're dreaming about as young kids. But most of them are uneducated and they just train in groups and they follow whatever the group is doing.
Wow.
So they have no concept of these physiological factors that influence distance running performance. They're just incredibly genetically gifted. They have the perfect body type for running with very thin legs. It's like a thoroughbred racehorse.
If you watch, high calves.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, because the more muscle mass you have distal from the knee down, the worse it is. The more it hurts running economy.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So they have very thin calves, and the muscle mass is situated more proximal toward the knee.
Yeah.
And even their thighs, I mean, they have legs that look like sticks.
Yes.
And they have long, slender Achilles tendons, which is great for propelling yourself like a jackrabbit, you know, across the ground.
Those slow fast twitch fibers are super easy for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it comes natural.
And it doesn't cost much oxygen for them to lift their leg up and put it down and lift it up and put it down because they have very lightweight legs.
Wow.
So, so they're perfectly built for running. And so you combine the genetics and the anatomy with the fact that they just run every single day, a lot, twice a day, and running is their way out of poverty.
They run twice a day.
Oh, yeah, they run twice a day every day, except their long run on Saturday because they're going so long. That's just one run that day. And then you have the socioeconomics, that running is their way out of poverty.
Wow.
I mean, imagine in the U.S. if we had one way, one athletic endeavor that was your only way out of poverty. So whatever athletic talent they have in the country is all funneled into running, into distance running, because they perceive that this is their only way out.
Wow.
And so that you have both the genetics and the socioeconomics merging together, and that's what makes them so good.
Yeah. What do you attribute their genetics to? Is it just their way they're living, their culture, their upbringing?
No, it's just their heritage, their ancestry.
Right.
Because the other thing that people don't realize about Kenya is that there's about 56 million people in Kenya, and they have a tribal system, like the way Native Americans have a tribal system in the U.S. They have about 40 tribes. There's only one tribe out of that 40 that are the distance runners, the Kalenjin.
Wow.
So most of Kenya doesn't run.
Wow.
You know, and you go to Nairobi, it's the major city, the capital. They have regular jobs, just like we have regular jobs here.
So there's the stereotype right there.
Yeah. But there's this one slice of Kenya that are the really good distance. So like all the athletes you've seen in the Olympics from Kenya, almost all of them come from the Kalenjin tribe.
Wow.
So there's the indication that this really is genetic.
Genetic.
Because it's not even all of Kenya. It's this one ancestry. And the Kalenjin, they all come from these rural farming towns. And then they all congregate to move to this town called Iten, I-T-E-N, Iten. And that's the epicenter of Kenyan distance running.
Wow.
There's a high school in Iten, St. Patrick's, that has graduated more Olympians, more future world record holders than any high school in the world.
Wow.
So, I mean, it is a pretty fascinating place to be.
Yeah.
It's very inspirational if you're a runner. And it's not like it's spread out in the U.S. Like if you walk outside your door, well, you don't see any runners, right, in the parking lot. You have to go to find the runner.
Yeah.
In Iten, there's about two or three paved roads. Everything else is these red dirt, rocky roads. You walk outside your door and there are the runners. I mean, you can't help but not see them. They're all over the town. It's a very small town and it's filled with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of elite runners.
Wow.
And so it's in your face all the time. The kids, as we were running, the kids are walking and running to school and they see world record holders running by and they see Olympians running by. So what do you think is going through their head? They aspire to do that.
Yeah.
And so they don't have to go looking for it. It's right there in front of them every single day. That's a pretty unique environment.
Yeah. It's a very unique environment.
Yeah. How's that socially though, as far as the economic impact and the shoes that they wear and stuff though? I mean,
So everything is given to them. So the only time, at least my group, so at the largest, I had 10 people in my group, and they have a small running shoe store there, but usually it's only for the visitors. Like there's a lot of international runners that will come there and spend a month at a time. There are a lot of guest houses for the runners to stay, because everybody wants to come and train with the Kenyans. So there's a lot of guest houses and they have a running shoe store, but the locals can't shop at the shoe store.
They
don't have $80 or $100 for a pair of shoes. So I actually took them once. They didn't know, this is a funny story. They didn't know who, I was there during Christmas time. They didn't know who Santa Claus was. You know, they don't, they're not told about the legend of Santa Claus growing up. And so I explained to them who Santa Claus was. And so I took them to the running shoe store at Christmas and I told them that I'm going to be your Santa Claus. And
so they were like, who are you? We don't care. You're, so first of all, they didn't say you're too skinny to be a Santa Claus.
Yeah, because I had no idea. They never seen images of Santa Claus. And,
they come over to the U.S. are like, wait a minute.
So I took them to the shoe store and bought them shoes. And I mean, their eyes lit. That was the first time they had ever worn a new pair of running shoes.
What would they normally run in? Like if they can afford
they do
it.
Wear Nike a lot, but it's given to them. Like when the international runners come, they give them clothes, they bring shoes with them. So the shoes that they are wearing and that you see in the picture, if you follow them on Instagram or whatever, you know, a lot of people post about them. And so all that's on their person, the shoes, the clothes, it's all handed to them. They're not going shopping for this stuff on their own.
Interesting.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Except like the superstar, like Ilya Kipchoge. Well, he's a millionaire probably even by American standards at this point, but certainly by Kenyan standards, he's a millionaire. But he's, you know, the exception to the rule. He's, you know, Faith Kipyegon, same thing. So all the superstars that we see at the Olympics, well, they're the ones who have made it. They're the ones who have gotten out of poverty and they've made it and they get endorsement deals and they're set for the rest of their lives. And then some of them come back and give back to the community. Others don't because they feel like they didn't have, you know, they have to work for it. We're not going to just get handed to them. Mm. Like physical work, physical labor is very, what's the word? It's very valued there. Like they, like in this town, they have like all these shops and they're building things and they don't have the machinery that we have here to build. So like you see these furniture stores. And then pouring outside the door of the furniture store, you see the welders and the workers. They're making everything by hand. And of course, then all the farming is done by hand. They don't have the big machinery that we have here. But it's very valued there. They don't think of it as, oh, you know, I wish I had a tractor. You know, I wish I had this
sewing machine.
Right. I wish I had a sewing machine. Yeah. I mean, you see these older women with these big jugs of water on their head because that's how they get water. They have to fetch it out of a borehole.
Yeah.
And so they go, you know, they walk to where the borehole is. They, just like in a big well, they with a pulley system, they put the basket down, they get the jug of water. And then you see these older, like senior citizen age women holding these big jugs of water on their head, walking back to their home. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like something you would think out of the 1800s when you're over there watching this stuff happen. But that's normal to them, and they value physical labor. It's just a part of their culture.
Does Kenya have a blue zone?
Right. I mean, you know, honestly, right? What is it? That was my next question. You're like, sitting there, do you know what their average life expectancy is there?
Because that's one of the things. Like, you're sitting there talking about how active they are, having to go through everyday life, and I'm thinking to myself, God. Is Kenny even a blue zone? Because
they live off the land.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
active every day. They run because they're trying to get out of poverty.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a definition of a healthy lifestyle. Like, and us, we're complaining because we got to walk 10 more steps because we got a shitty parking spot at the Home Depot. You know?
It would be interesting to study the rural towns in Kenya and what the lifespan is there.
Right.
Yeah. Like when you go to Nairobi, you see overweight people. You see,
it's just like
see like it is in America. Even though there, it's still not a major city like it is here.
Right.
Yeah. Like when I went to Nairobi, I never saw a traffic light. I was driving around in a taxi. I never saw a traffic light.
Hmm.
So, and you still see a lot of dirt and, you know, you don't have the fancy buildings that you have here. In fact, while I was there, I ran one race that on a highway. They had just finished this brand new expressway in Nairobi and they wanted to show it off. And so they ran a race on the new highway. So that was pretty cool because you're running on the highway overlooking the skyscrapers of the city. And that was pretty neat. But that was brand new for them. So even a city in Kenya is not like a city, you know, in the U.S. It's still pretty different.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You said you went over there to learn. I'll let you answer this next question. What was your biggest takeaway from that trip? What was the biggest thing you learned?
Well, there was a few. I mean, one is the nutritional aspect. We put such an emphasis in the U.S. on fueling. You got to eat. Mm. But you go over there and you see what they're capable of doing and how much running they're able to do and how fast they're able to run on such little food. And it makes you realize that, you know, we can train metabolism. You know, it may take many, many years of doing things a certain way to train them, because they do it from the time that they're little kids. Mm. And maybe they even do it from the time they're in their mother's womb.
Because the mom's
Because the mothers aren't getting a lot of nutrition.
Interesting.
So it may even be starting prior to their birth.
Conception.
But yeah. Metabolism is something that can be trained.
Wow.
We don't need to eat so much. And in America, we eat so much.
Yeah.
And we've become dependent. Our bodies have become dependent on eating so much because that's how we grow up. That's what we're used to.
Mm.
But it doesn't have to be that way.
Your biggest takeaway was nutrition.
Yeah, so that was a big one. And the other is just realizing, well, number one, how great we have it in the U.S.
Mm.
That you really realize that when you see, like I saw the way my athletes were living and I couldn't believe it. If I had to live that way, I would have lasted a week there. I mean, no running water, no toilet. They go in an outhouse. You know, they live in a wood and tin, what we would think is a shed, like a tool shed. That's what, no window, no nothing. The ground is the ground from outside. It's the dirt from outside makes the floor of their home. You know, one girl I was coaching, I saw the interior of her home. It was literally smaller than this room that we're in now.
Wow.
And there was nothing. There was, no sink, no electricity, no nothing.
Yeah.
And it's like, imagine living a life like that. It's
pretty emotional.
Unbelievable.
It.
Yeah. But the thing is, they're happy. They're still happy. They're not playing victim. They're not like, oh, woe is me. You know, my life is hell.
I slept on a dirt, dirt road.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and then in this country too, we're so about mental health right now. Mental health this, mental health that. Are you kidding me? We have it made in this country. What's the problem?
Yeah.
And yet they don't have any mental health problems over there. And yet look at the way they're living.
Wow.
With so it's all things. Yeah, it's all a matter of perspective.
Social media. That's
it
is.
It definitely plays a role into it. Absolutely. Yeah. But I firmly believe what the doc is saying here. Like you get. Tony Robinson talked about it in one of his speeches. I remember he went to Fiji. And they were like one of the most poverty neighborhoods, right? It's very similar to Kenya, right? But just tropical, right? Mm-hmm. And he said they were out there. He goes, how do some populations have absolutely nothing, sleeping on dirt beds, but yet they're the happiest on the planet?
Yeah.
And so it's like stripping away everything. Right. Yes, social media has a play to it. But if you have nothing and you could celebrate, like we talked about Legos at the beginning of the podcast, mm-hmm. right? I played with rocks, and I was perfectly freaking content stacking rocks.
Well, it's also the minimalist lifestyle, right? If you don't know what the U.S. and the first world country has to offer as far as more, like you can be completely content. And
They don't know from that.
They don't know, it makes them happier. I get it. Again, social media. And
they're not comparing.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they're comparing in the sense that they know that the rest of the world doesn't live like them. That's why they want to get out of poverty.
Yeah,
so they're trying to escape that. So they do know that most people have a toilet to flush. You know, they do know these things. But since they don't grow up with it, since they haven't lived it themselves, they have no means of comparison. Right, exactly. Yeah. They have no means of comparison in that regard. So,
did you change anything in your coaching habits when you got back?
Yeah, I've always been, and because of my training as a scientist, I've always been about the science.
Right.
And I've come to realize that there can be a good blend of both. That yes, you need the science. It is a physiological sport. And so you have to know the science.
Mm.
But there's also the feeling. There's also the, pushing when you feel good and not pushing when you don't feel good. And there's an undulating rhythm that that they are in tune with. And they have this extreme sense of pace. Like you put them in a race. If you ever watch them at the Olympics and you watch how they run as a team, the Americans never run as a team. The Americans, you have one person here in the pack, one person here, one person there. The Kenyans, the Ethiopians do this very well too. They run as a team. They run all together, blocking the other runners because for them, unlike in the U.S., we live in a very individualistic society. And we celebrate the accomplishments of individuals. Over there, it's all about the country. If one Kenyan is successful, everybody's successful. The country is successful. And they take that very seriously. Wow. So they always run as a team. And they have this very internal sense of pace. They know exactly what's going on every second of the race, how much that they can increase the pace to drop other runners, or what they have to do. Like they can really strategize, whereas runners from other countries, including the U.S., can't necessarily do that because the U.S. runners are just hanging on to the pace, trying to stay up with them, whereas the Kenyans are controlling what's going on in the race. Mm. And that's fascinating to watch when I was there as well, because I had the opportunity to take them to some races. And then, like, there was this one guy in particular, when I was coaching during workouts, he seemed, like, so lazy. Like, I had to constantly, like, nudge him along. But then when you put him on the starting line for a race, it's like something changed in him, and now he's a master of what's going on. Yeah. And he can win the race because he can control what's going on. And it was just a fascinating thing to watch. And so you wouldn't think that that would happen because they don't understand the science. They don't know anything from that. They don't know periodization. They don't even know individualized training. They all train in groups and they do whatever the group is doing. They just follow along.
Yeah.
But the reason why they can all succeed on one cookie cutter training plan is because of their ancestry, because all the cookies in the jar are of the same type. Whereas here you put a group of runners together in the U.S., they're going to have different strengths and weaknesses because we come from different ancestries. You know, the U.S. is a melting pot of all different ancestries. Yeah. But because there's just this one tribe in Kenya that are the good distance runners, the cookies are all the same.
It's really easy.
So they can all get by on this one pattern of training that they have developed over the years.
I talk about confidence. We talk about that, like in strength training, like the confidence underneath the barbell, especially when you're pushing at the top level of your capacity. The command control
you
of
better
that
be
way.
In
you
control,
better be extremely confident. If you go in with the mindset of not, right? And so it's pretty impressive to do it from like a running perspective, right?
And that's the way their mindset is too. I mean, they have no doubt. You talk to everyone in that town of Eton, they have no doubt that they can be the next world champion.
Wow.
I mean, and that's what they're all training for. Now, of course, in reality, they're not all going to break through and make it.
Right.
But they don't know that. They really believe that if you do the physical work, success in running fast is the logical conclusion of doing the physical work. To them, it's all physical. There's no doubt. There's no mind games. They just do the physical work, and they wholeheartedly believe that it's all about the physical work.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's
I've been reading a lot more about, like, running, right? I'm reading Run Faster, I'd Run a 5K and a Marathon Faster, Fitzgerald and Henderson.
You better be reading some of my books, too.
I will. Trust me, it's on the list now for sure, especially your periodization. I kind of read the synopsis on that, and I'm really interested in that. Because I coach High Rocks, and it's a running sport, and how to program for athletes at different levels, you know, to have the talent level of a Kenyan runner would be awesome, but obviously we don't.
I'm kind of interested, before we get into the current book, because you were into like the 80-20 rule.
Yeah.
Before you're now into what you're reading now.
Correct.
And I'm curious on your philosophy on
talk
some
a lot
of that.
About that in the periodization book.
Okay.
Because that's really just, I don't want to say a myth. It's just, it's commercialized in a way that shouldn't be.
Mm.
Because there's an inverse relationship between volume and intensity. So all that is an artifact of the inverse relationship. The more volume you do, by necessity, the much more of it is going to have to be done at a low intensity.
Interesting.
But if you're only running 30 miles a week, does that mean 80% of it should be at a low intensity? You could do that, but it's going to take you a long time to get fit. You know, sprinters are well known for high intensity all the time because their volume is very low.
Mm.
You know, a sprint workout may just be 4 times 200 meters, very, very fast.
Yeah.
And that's the entire workout. So they're only doing half a mile of volume, but that's why they can do high intensity. And the same thing is extended to distance runners. The reason why, where that came from is the descriptive research on all the best endurance athletes in the world, running, cross-country skiing, cycling.
Interesting.
And it turns out that they hover around 80%, even up to maybe 90% of their volume is done at a relatively easy intensity, and the rest is a high intensity, high meaning above threshold intensity.
Threshold. Yeah.
But that's also because the Kenyans are running, you know, twice a day, every day. They're running upwards of 100 plus miles per week.
Interesting.
So sure, if you're running 100 miles per week, somewhere around 80 of those miles are going to have to be done. You can't do 50 miles of intense work if you're running 100 miles a week. You're going to kill yourself. But if you're running 100 miles a week and 20% of that is hard, that's still 20 miles a week of high intensity.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. The second issue is that because these great endurance athletes have such a high VO2 max, even at a low intensity, they're getting a pretty strong stimulus. Like if you run easy at 70%, if your VO2 max is 80, let's make the math easy because I know we're on a podcast. It's
hard to do. And we want to make sure that our listeners right. stay engaged, okay?
I don't want people to think I can't do math.
Well, I'm skirting that line right now. Like, I don't know how deep we want to get into this conversation, but go ahead.
So if your VO2 max is 80, right. which is on the lower end yeah, of an right. elite of an Olympic level endurance athlete, if your VO2 max is 80 and you're running easy at 70% of that, which is an easy run, 70% of VO2 max is a pretty easy feeling run. Mm-hmm. Well, 70% of 80 is 56, right? 7 times 8 is 56. So you're running at a VO2 of 56 mLs per kg per minute. Well, 56 is already higher than the VO2 max of most recreational runners. So even when they're running easy, they have a very large oxygen flux to the muscle, which is the stimulus for adaptation. One of the stimuli for adaptation anyway. There's a lot of stimuli, but that's one of them, is the oxygen flux to the muscle for the capillarization and other issues, metabolism. So even at a low intensity, they still have a high oxygen flux to the muscle, whereas someone who has a VO2 max of 40 and they're running at 70% of that, that's only a VO2 of 28.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty low VO2. So even at an easy intensity, the more highly trained elite endurance athlete is getting more of a stimulus at 70% of their VO2 max than someone with a recreational level VO2 max. Mm. So the stimulus is not the same either. But all of this stuff is forgotten about or not understood by the people on social media. And so they keep promoting this whole 80-20 thing, not mm-hmm. understanding that that's really nothing more than just an artifact of the inverse relationship between volume and intensity.
Right.
And that shouldn't even stay 80-20 through the whole year.
Yeah, this is the book that I'm reading now. It talked about that wholeheartedly. Yeah. It's like moving the line
right.
based off of feeling. And so that's why I'm very interested in the Kenya conversation because they're doing it based off of, obviously they're doing a cookie cutter program, but it's all based off of feeling. They don't have any science in there. Because genetically they are they're favored to be one of the fastest runners in the planet. When now the material that I'm reading now talks about he specifically says, write your training programs in pencil.
Yeah, because it should always change.
Could always change. Just because
they don't even write anything in Kenya.
It's all right here. Yeah. And so it's like you write it in pencil. You're like, what does that mean? And so he talks about moving the needle just so that you can never attain it. Right. And so you're constantly moving that needle based off of that. And it's based off of a feeling. Yes, you are looking at overall volume perspective for you. You know, you're not going to tell somebody to go out, run a 10K if they've never ran more than a mile in a week. Like you can obtain a 1 mile. Yeah. You know what I mean? You can obtain the same data by telling that same athlete to go run a mile.
Yeah.
Right. Versus go tell them to run a 10K.
And the volume needle should increase over time, even more so than the intensity needle. Because the single big, there's a lot of factors that influence distance running performance, of course, but the single biggest factor is the weekly volume. There's a reason why the best runners in the world run upwards of 100 miles per week. And that takes time. I mean, they don't start doing that as, 10-year-olds, but they grow up running back and forth to school, so they're already running quite a lot. Yeah. You know, they're not driving around in cars like we are, so they live a life that's very physical. It's on their feet all the time. And so, but you can accomplish that in the U.S. too, that over time, from year to year, you start increasing the volume so that by the time you're in your mid to late 20s, when you're at your peak performance level, then you're running as much as you can physically and psychologically handle.
So say that again. The volume is a greater than the intensity.
For endurance sports, But the intensity has to move. So also the volume of intensity is very important. So it's always a volume thing. Whereas for sprinting, it's all an intensity thing, right? You got to run fast. But for endurance athletes, it's all about the overall volume and then the volume of intensity. So maybe when you first start out, say, let's just pick a random workout, 400 meter reps. Maybe the first time you do 400 meter reps in your lifetime, maybe you just do 3 or 4 of them. But then 10 years later, maybe you're doing 20 of them. And so you're running at the same speed, but now you're able to handle a greater volume at that intensity. That's a signifying characteristic of maturing as an athlete, is that you're able to accomplish more volume at a given intensity.
Interesting. Geeking out right now, dude.
Oh, I know. I knew there would be a connection.
Geeking out right now, dude.
I knew there would be a connection because I know what you're reading and what you've been studying because of the Hyrox training perspective. So I thought it'd be kind of interesting.
100%. It's like I can train somebody underneath a barbell all day long, and I feel very confident in that coaching ability. I personally am not a runner, as you can see.
But well, I would argue that every human is
a runner. Yes. Exactly. Okay. Yes, it's a good argument.
Jason made this point when he came in. He's like, "Man, you're much bigger than I thought you were going to be." He's like, "You're definitely not built like a runner like I am." And I'm like, "No, I'm Clydesdale division."
Clydesdale division.
In a running context. Yeah. On the board of the USATF San Diego. So I just assumed that
he was a runner. He's gonna run.
Definitely not built like a runner. That's for sure.
Definitely not.
Again, Clydesdale division. You're in the same boat.
So yeah, 100%, dude. You lost me after 5K, bro. But you're right. Everybody has a capability of running. What's your take on some of these other sports? I don't know how much you're tracking. I mean, outside of track and field, cross country, and endurance-based running, are you seeing, I'm seeing a lot of other, like, functional running sports out there. What's your take on those?
Well, I think anytime we can include running in something else, it's going to be beneficial to people. I mean, I'm a little biased in that, but I do think that running is, if you had only one exercise that you could be allowed to do for the rest of your life in terms of fitness and health and mortality, I mean, running is it. And, you know, there's a mountain of research evidence to show the benefits of running, both physically and psychologically, you know, the whole runner's high thing. I mean, you know, I've never heard of the football player's high or the weightlifter's high. You know, you don't necessarily.
Well, you never see me in the weight room.
Oh, right? Yeah, that's true. That's true. Maybe you should start that term.
Yeah. Weightlifter's high. Yeah. That's going to be, I'm going to go get a PhD in that right now.
But there's a reason why we have that term for running. Right. You know, that didn't come about by accident. It's because people recognize that running, I mean, it's almost meditative in that sense. And, yeah. And so what it does for you psychologically and how it gives you that high. And I think the reason why running gives you that and other things may not is because running is who we are as animals. Whereas other activities, you have to learn how to do it. It's, you know, cycling is not a normal physical activity for humans. Swimming is not a normal physical. We're not fish. You know, we can't breathe underwater like fish can. So other activities, while they have their own benefits, they're not who we are as animals. We're mammals, and mammals run, and that's who we are.
We like to be on our feet.
Yeah.
That was what his TED talk was about.
My TED talk is how running like an animal makes us human. And so, that's, running is who we are. And people tend to forget that because people don't see humans as animals for some reason. And I always have, ever since I was a kid, because we share a biology and we share on anatomy as well. The only difference is that we walk and run on two legs instead of four. But the way our muscles work, the way our cardiovascular system works, the way our breathing works, everything is the same as all these other mammals. Mm. You know, and for some reason, people don't see humans as animals, but we are. The only difference is, you know, what's between our ears, that our brain is more highly evolved than compared to, but you take away the brain, and we're exactly the same as all these other animals.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Let's fast forward to the can you out and run a donut? I haven't had a chance to tap into
this. It's on my list.
Yet.
Oh, you got to read
the periodization right? First for me. Yeah. Though, okay, yeah. So that's first for me.
I haven't had a chance to tap
into this. I have an eclectic menu.
Yeah. I know. Books. We got 17 books we got to catch up on, bro. Right?
So talk to us about where the idea for this book comes in.
Yeah.
And is it a lot of nutrition-based for running, or is it?
Oh, no. It's not. So it's not about running at all, really.
Okay.
Interesting.
It's all about the comparison. Because nobody else has made this direct comparison. There's research on it, but nobody in the industry has really made a direct comparison between exercise and nutrition. And you usually hear, you know, speaking of 80-20, that's another 80-20 thing I've always heard in the fitness industry,
right,
is that your physique and your fitness, your body is 80% nutrition and 20% exercise. Coming from the background I come from, I know that that's not true, but I needed some proof. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to put this to the test. And I always was familiar with a lot of the research because just being in this field and background I have, I read a lot and I read a lot of science. So I already knew that what the answer was before I wrote the book. But I wanted to write the book anyway for no other reason than to prove it to myself. But I wanted to also prove it to everyone else because the public, if you Google, can you outrun a bad diet? you're going to get a million things come up to say that, no, you can't.
Yeah.
And so it amazes me how many people get this question wrong. And, you know, I'm giving away the answer to the question of the book, but
spoiler alert.
But that's all right. You still have to read the book. But so I, you know, I want to delve into the enormous body of research on this subject. And I look at it from four different perspectives: body weight, health, mortality, and performance. And from any way you look at it, you know, I mean, it's pretty clear that you can easily outrun a dog if you're willing to do the physical work. So I use outrun as the metaphor, but it could be any form of exercise. But cardiovascular exercise is more effective, especially for burning calories.
From a caloric burn perspective, absolutely.
So when it comes to, and then also the other confusion is with body weight, is that, you know, the conversation always stops at weight loss. And if you're just looking to lose weight and you don't care what happens after you lose the weight, then nutrition is more, then your diet is more important than exercise. The research is very clear on this. To lose weight, the diet is more important than exercise. But what happens to most people who lose weight?
It comes right back.
The conversation cannot stop at weight loss. It has to keep going, because what's important is the rest of your life, keeping that weight off the rest of your life. And for weight maintenance, to keep the weight off for the rest of your life, exercise easily outcompetes nutrition. There's a lot of research to show that how much weight is on your body is directly proportional to the amount of exercise you do. And longitudinal studies have shown this, that the more people decrease how much they run or exercise, the more weight they put on. You know, so I wanted to really dig into all this research. So the book is basically a scientific literature review on, I mean, I got 344 references at the back of this book. So, I mean, I spent a long time just reading and interpreting the research and, you know, and talking about the different research studies and what they have found and why they found what they found, and to really compare nutrition and exercise, because I really think that that can direct policy in the future, that can direct weight loss programs, because everyone focuses on the diet. Eat this, don't eat that.
Buy this supplement.
Right, exactly. Yeah, supplements are huge, especially since they're not regulated by the FDA. So anybody can sell whatever supplement they want and say it's a magic wonder drug. And there's no regulation on supplements, you know. And so, but people get the answer to the question wrong, that you can outrun a donut. And in fact, that's where the emphasis should be. We need to stop worrying so much about the diet. Of course, the best combination is exercise a lot and eat well. That is, the research is clear on that too. That's the best case scenario. But if you're going to spend a lot of time, energy, and money on programming and stuff, the exercise component is more important. And one of the main reasons why exercise is more important is because nutrition can't do a damn thing for your fitness. Nutrition does not make you fitter.
No.
Now, there are five components to physical fitness: cardiovascular, endurance, muscular strength, muscular endurance, flexibility, and body composition. Nutrition can only affect the body composition. It cannot make your muscles stronger. It cannot improve your VO2 max, which should be treated like a vital sign, a person's VO2 max. It's so important to tell you about a person's cardiovascular health that it should be treated like a vital sign. Just like we measure blood pressure and pulse oximetry, we should also measure VO2 max, although it's harder to do than measuring someone's heart rate and blood
pressure. That's why they don't do it quite often.
But now with some of the wearables, they're trying to get closer to predicting what someone's VO2 max is. So it's still not that accurate yet, but it's getting better. You know, the heart rate measurement has to be perfect in order for the prediction of VO2 max to be correct. But that's, you know, that's what exercise does. You know, it improves your cardiovascular fitness, improves your muscular strength, improves your flexibility, improves your muscular endurance. Nutrition can't do any of those things. And the fitness is what matters more. I mean, the other thing that the research shows is it's better to be fat and fit than to be thin and out of shape. You know, in terms of health and mortality, it's the fitness that matters, not the amount of body weight that you have on your body. You know, it's the fitness that matters much more.
I coach this a lot, especially because I own a gym. And one of the things that I hate about doing in my gym is selling. And it's a nasty necessity. And when I get people in, their number one question is, like, tell me what to eat. You know, and I'm like,
focus on that.
Look, you just move. Let's just start planning to move for 30 days. And that's my number one response to them. But, and I'm like, trust me on this. Just start moving for 30 days. Show yourself that you can move regularly for 30 days. Honor that commitment. And whatever that commitment is, two, three, four, five times a week, whatever that is, keep moving. But then we like bolt on the nutritional aspect, which doesn't have to be extravagant, right? I mean, you just talked about Kenyans running on minimal calories, right? And so obviously they do that through several years of genetic just disposition that they have. However, in the United States, we have a calorie overconsumption issue. And so just pulling that back from them or peeling back that onion and showing them that really, if you just understand what your total daily energy expenditure is, and it's not a perfect fucking science. It's not, right? It's you're basing it on how you feel, based off of how much stress level you have, what's your age, what's your body composition, all these things. And it's one of the hardest things that I have to sell as a gym owner. Yeah. It's the hardest thing that
And that's probably because of society. They're always pushing the nutrition. It's diet this, diet that. And the other thing the research shows is every single diet works as long as they do one thing, reduce calories.
Yeah.
And one of my other, I have one book called Run Your Fat Off, and I tell stories to frame each chapter of people who have lost a lot of weight through running. And I tell the story of Dr. Mark Haub. He's a nutrition professor, metabolism professor at Kansas State University. And he was a runner in college. And he himself, you know, after he became a professor, he stopped the run. He himself had to lose weight. Mm. And he wanted to try this thing for his metabolism class, which became known as the Twinkie diet. He was just going to eat Twinkies and ding-dongs.
I've heard about this. Yeah. It's good, dude. It's so good.
And he got a lot of press for this. He made the morning TV talk shows about this.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is going back a little ways now. But he limited himself to 1,600 to 1,800 calories a day, only eating Twinkies and ding-dongs and all the food that we think is obesogenic, foods that make us fat. And what happened? He did this for 10 weeks. And he dropped a lot. I don't remember the exact numbers in my head now. I have to go back and read it in my own book. But he lost a lot of weight, and his blood lipid profile all got better. His triglycerides got better, cholesterol got better, because that's what happens when you lose weight. Even though you're eating this stuff that we consider being junk food, but his blood lipid profile got better because he lost a lot of weight, even though he was eating all this garbage. But because he limited himself to 1,600 to 1,800 calories a day, his health got better, and his body weight got better. So it's not really about what you eat. That's why I came up with the quirky title, Can You Outrun a Donut? Because the donut is the symbol for what people think is bad food.
Yeah, unhealthy.
But, if you eat less, even if you're eating ice cream, if you ate only 1,000 calories a day, but it was only ice cream, you're going to lose weight because 1,000 calories a day is not much.
Yeah,
that's why I love going overseas. You go to Europe and you got a smaller plates and you're eating a lot less and you're like, oh, this is, and you're eating more because you're eating smaller things, but it's a lot less per and you're like, oh, this is great. Right.
I tell that Twinkie story all the time to my clients. One of my clients actually liked pizza.
Yeah.
He said, I get you to lose weight eating pizza. And they're like, no way. Like, yeah. Watch me. It's so
somehow
cool.
People associate the junk food with increasing body weight, not understanding that it's the calories.
Yeah, it's a calorie.
You could eat, if you ate 5,000 calories a day of kale, you're still going to gain weight.
Yeah.
But I don't think anybody can eat 5,000 calories a day of kale.
Yeah.
That'd be hard to stomach.
I
need to see what their bowel movements are like, dude.
Right.
But to that point, though, it's too, you get into this, I'm just going to eat some salads. And then all of a sudden you start piling in the dressing and all that stuff. And as to that point, you can have 5,000 calories of kale or 5,000 calories of a salad. You're still going to start gaining weight based on that, right?
It's
such a fun.
All I had was a salad of 5,000 calories.
You walk into a restaurant though here in California, and sometimes the salads are a lot more caloric intake than a pizza. Yeah.
And they add all this other stuff to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
the other thing that I talk about in the book that is fascinating research that people are so unaware of is that even one bout of exercise can undo the negative effects of eating a high fat or high sugar meal. There's a lot of interesting research where they feed these subjects enormous amount of calories over a several week period of time, and then they have them exercise or not exercise, and they look at health outcomes. They look at the blood lipid profile. They look at dilation of blood vessels and what's called flow-mediated dilation, which tells you the health of the endothelial cells that line the vessels. And so they look at, in response to a stimulus, how much you know, in response to a certain amount of blood flow, how much the vessel dilates. It's called flow-mediated dilation. Mm. And that could tell us the health of the blood vessels. And, you know, eating a high-fat or high-sugar meal, you know, does damage to the blood vessels, but exercise, we can mitigate and in some cases even erase that damage. And so it's fascinating the effects that exercise has on what we would consider a bad diet.
Where do you apply, in your expertise, you know, we talk about strength training like in the 80s, right? And what that was, you got the Arnold Schwarzeneggers piling all this muscle mass that really probably was, which mimics obesity in a lot of ways. Where do you apply strength training into like the sport of running?
Well, that gets into a whole nother topic. It's something I've been pretty vocal about over the years. But it depends on what the person's goals are. Like for the average person who is running for health and fitness, strength training can play a huge role in that. Mm. For someone who's looking at more for performance, or if they're strength training for the purpose of injury, prevent injuries, then the evidence is not as strong that it does those two things. Mm. Especially for running injuries, the evidence that that you should strength train to prevent the kinds of injuries that runners get, very weak evidence. There's not very much evidence that strength training actually prevents the kinds of injuries that runners get. For performance, the evidence is mixed, but it really is tied to the improvement in running economy. Like strength training does not improve VO2 max. It doesn't improve lactate threshold. Yeah. It doesn't improve the other aerobic physiological factors that influence running. It may have a small improvement in running economy, but only if you strength train the right way, which is very heavy or explosive movements.
Mm.
Not doing the body weight squats or the planks and the crunches. That kind of strength training is not going to improve performance. The only kind of strength training that has any chance of improving performance is if you lift with very heavy weights, like in excess of 90% one rep max, or explosive kind of strength training, like the plyometrics and that kind of stuff. That's been shown, but not even all studies have shown that. And the studies that have shown improvement in economy, a very small difference in the way they measure economy is looking at what the VO2 is at a given submaximal speed.
Interesting.
And most of the studies have only measured one or two submax speeds, and they've only shown a very small difference in what the VO2 is compared to a control group that didn't strength train.
Mm.
So the evidence even for that isn't very strong. And even if you could improve economy, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get faster, because it's one of many variables that influence performance. You know, that's like when Nike came out with their first version of the carbon-plated shoes, they called it the 4%, the Vaporfly 4%, because they showed a 4% improvement in running economy. But that does not equally translate to a 4% improvement in performance.
Interesting.
But the public is a little naive to that. And so they think, oh, I'm going to get 4%
faster.
Yeah. Yeah. What is that in a marathon? That's a lot in a marathon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, but that's a lot of marketing. But the same thing with strength training, that the studies that have shown an improvement in economy, number one, they haven't measured that many speeds to look at the change in VO2 at given speeds. Most of them have only showed one speed. And some studies have looked at two different speeds.
Interesting.
And then the ones that have shown a very small difference. So is there while that difference in those studies was statistically significant, and that's what scientists live and die by is statistics, does that translate to a more, you know, real life improvement in performance? Maybe, maybe not.
Interesting. Interesting. Because that's like the one thing a lot of my runners are afraid to do is lift heavy.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want, I'm a runner. Right. I don't want to lift heavy.
And now, having said that, though, it's got to be so heavy that you don't increase muscle mass.
Correct.
Because
you're increasing CNS, you're increasing strength.
It's all got to be a neural aspect of improving strength.
Correct.
Yeah. And that's why really heavy, like if you go 70% 1RM or 80% 1RM, there's the chance that you can, if you do enough volume of that, you're going to add muscle mass. And that's what a runner doesn't want.
Yeah.
A sprinter, yes, but a distance runner, no, because that will hurt your economy.
Correct.
Because that's why the best runners weigh very little. It costs less oxygen to transport that weight over.
Right.
Is that my problem? Have I just been doing too much 70 to 80%?
No.
And
bro.
I'm just.
Well, yes. You never load the barbell. You never load the barbell beyond all recognition. You see me doing that, but I'm still slow as hell, bro. But yeah, yeah, it's interesting to me because that's this conversation. I mean, we can definitely go into a rabbit hole and kind of dive into that science. But
I like a rabbit hole.
Yeah, we've got plenty in this conversation. But yeah, it's very, very interesting to me. You're absolutely right. When the information that I've read and the books that I'm reading don't have a whole lot of information on.
Well, mine do. You haven't read my books
yet. Yeah, I'm going to read it. But yeah, definitely on there. Especially, again, I read the synopsis and the periodization. I'm really, really intrigued.
Yeah, so there's
a
chapter in that book on strength training.
Okay.
And then I ended up taking that chapter, since I'd already pretty much done the lit review for that chapter. I took that chapter and then created a scientific review paper that was accepted by a journal last October.
Interesting.
So I have a review paper that looked at strength training. They looked at all the studies that had ever been done up to that point. So the 45 total studies that I looked at, the effects of strength training on distance running performance and on running injury prevention. So I reviewed all those studies and then got a narrative review published on that.
Interesting, because it's very specific, right? We talk a lot about VO2 max and the cardiovascular components of running, the muscular biomechanics stuff, but sport-specific matters as well.
Of course.
And so if we're talking just running, then improving the biomechanics or the run efficiency in a particular athlete from a strength perspective, then obviously that's the information that I'm looking for when I'm reading your book.
Of course.
However, when we're talking sports-specific, right, CrossFit athlete, for example, right, or a Hyrox athlete, for example, that has to push a 335-pound sled, just running efficiency is not going to do it for them.
Right. Yeah, they need a little bit of everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's kind
of... They're more well-rounded type athletes, whereas a pure runner is just a pure cyclist or pure swimmer. It's very unique to that activity, but you know, the whole CrossFit movement, and those are much more well-rounded types of athletes.
Well, just like learning that, I mean, I can sit here and read a bunch of books on reading, and I feel like I have a very good confidence level in the amount of strength training and my programming for that. However, the running aspect, and then the last component of all those things is kind of marrying the two, and what does that look like? Because if I go very specific in a type of training modality one way, then it's going to impact their run efficiency, right? But if I improve their run efficiency, then they're not going to be very efficient in the strength movements, right? And so kind of like finding that balance.
That's what's
is
hard
kind
to
of,
get right, because there
hard.
Is incompatibility between strength training and aerobic endurance training.
100%.
And so that's why you don't want to add any muscle mass at all, because the two major reasons, we already talked about, that it costs more. You know, it hurts your economy because it costs more oxygen to transport that body. It also has to do with the capillary density.
Interesting.
The larger, and this is one thing also that the Kenyans benefit from, by not having a lot of muscle mass on your legs, and by doing all that cardiovascular training, which increases capillary density, I mean, you want as many capillaries per square millimeter of muscle as possible because you enhance diffusion of oxygen from the capillary inside the muscle mitochondria.
Interesting.
The larger the muscle mass is, then the fewer capillaries you have per unit area of muscle, then you're going to have to like try to overcome that with more aerobic exercise to make more capillaries. Like, you want this intricate spider web network surrounding the muscle fibers, and you want as many capillaries surrounding the muscle fibers as possible to enhance oxygen diffusion. And so, the less muscle mass you have on your legs for a distance runner, the better it is, because it enhances capillary density.
Which is possible, which is doable, right? I mean, I've been in a lot of powerlifting competitions and stuff like that. You watch a 180-pound guy lifting 300, 400 pounds. It's like, how's that possible? So it's totally doable. So enough about that rabbit hole. So I will keep going, dude, on and on, and I'll keep on like sponging off of your knowledge and information.
That's so good. I don't want to take too much more of your time, so I want to say thank you for coming in
and
talking about, you know, a lot of your books and some of the science behind it. I know, I knew that you were going to geek out on a lot of this conversation.
That's great, though. I mean, this has been my life since I was 11 years old.
Yeah, and
I've been immersed in this subject.
Yeah, and so
I love it. I mean, I could talk about this all day long.
Other than your books, though, how does somebody get in contact with you to kind of like... Are you teaching anywhere right now?
Not now. I mean, last year I was a visiting professor over in Georgia. I moved to Georgia to be a visiting professor at Georgia Southern University. So that was fun. I was teaching undergrads and grad students.
Right.
That was great. But now, I'm completely on my own.
Interesting. Yeah. So talk to us about your certification, because that's something I might want to give some of my coaches to do.
Yeah, so in 2015, I created my own run coaching certification course. And then, but I'm not involved in that. Anyway, I sold that business in 2022 to International Sports Sciences Association, ISSA. Okay. So they're a big fitness education company. They sell lots of different courses on different topics. And so I was happy to sell the course to them. So I started looking for a buyer for that during the pandemic, because at the time I offered it two different ways, as a home study course that people could do on their own. And I was traveling to teach the course. Mm. And I loved that. But then that got all shut down during the pandemic. So when that happened, I thought, well, I could still keep pushing the home study course for people to buy, but I don't know if I want to, I don't know how long the pandemic's going to last, and I want to teach the course.
A lot of insurgents.
So I started looking around for someone to acquire it from me. So I was happy to find someone to do that. And so, yeah, so I haven't been involved in that since the end of 2022, but ISSA still sells the course and it's on their website now. And so, yeah, it's my course. They just sell it and they oversee it.
They didn't change it, that you know of?
No, not that. No, I think they broke up. Like, I had 9 manuals, so I think they broke up or divided the manuals into different sections.
Interesting.
So that people don't have to do it all in one shot. But there's no more live course to it, because they don't teach a live course. And so, but now all the certifications, they've all moved to online. No one teaches anything in person anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it's still available. It's just through them now instead of me.
Where can people find your books?
Oh, they're all on Amazon. You know, it's funny to me when people ask me, because, you know, Amazon started as only selling books.
Only selling books.
And guess what? They still just sell books.
Exactly.
They still sell books. Now they sell everything else.
Yeah.
But they still sell books. So yeah, all of my books, they're on my website, but most of the links on my website go directly to Amazon anyway.
And what's your website?
DrJasonKarp.com.
There you go.
And of course, on social media, at Dr. Jason Karp is my...
Make sure you give a follow.
On social media, yeah.
And any of your books on Audible?
I think there's 2 or 3. So the publishers are responsible for that. So they're not even my voice. They're probably better that it's not my voice. I don't
know if we've established that I'm the golden voice here in the group.
Oh. Right, you do have a radio
I need to read some of your books and record them, bro.
Narrate them.
Great.
You could become my narrator.
There you go, baby.
Great.
I found my niche finally, bro.
Damn it.
So yeah, there's just, I think, 2 or 3, but they hire a professional narrator to...
Yeah.
To go into a studio and narrate it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I have nothing to do with the audio
I'm hoping
version.
That the periodization one's is on Audibles, dude.
Oh, that one's not.
Dang it.
Yeah.
You're just going to have
to. I'm just going to have to hard nose it, dude.
Just raw dog that one, man.
Yeah, I'm running raw dog.
Just raw dog it and just read it.
I personally love the physical book, even more than, I don't even own a Kindle. I like having a book in my hand. I'm a little old school, I guess, because that's how I grew up. But it's always amazing to me when people ask me about audio books and, you know, I know there's different kinds of learners and maybe other people learn through hearing. But for me, I like to sit with a book in my hand and really read it. And in case I have to read the paragraph again, or I do that a lot because I study the, especially when I'm reading something that's more technical, you know, unlike a novel where you only have to read a sentence once and your eyes graze over it. But with a more of a technical book or learning about training, and to me, it's, you know, I study it, so I have to reread the same thing over and over. And obviously, you can't do that with audio unless you keep going back and playing it back, and that's a little awkward.
I'm an audio guy for sure, but I'm also, because I have several disabilities in my learning, right? And so I have to read the book. It has to capture me. I feel like there's nuggets in there. Once I grab the nuggets, I go, okay, I need to grab the book in person because I retain different information by reading it versus just listening to it.
Right.
So, yeah. Interesting.
And
all
you
right.
can highlight, you know, you can't highlight an audio book.
No.
You can highlight the text.
All right.
Yeah. Jason, thanks, man, for coming in. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Keep it coming.
This has been an international podcast transmission of No Fixed Agenda presented by Bubs Naturals. Music was provided by The Poor Dirty Astronauts with lyrics written by Matt Meyer. You can rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you find your favorite podcast episodes. NFA, over and out.